Encounter podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Encounter AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling, well, a real puzzle in global affairs, the United Nations. It's this huge institution central to how we think about world order, but honestly, it gets slammed constantly. Either it's too weak or somehow too powerful, right?
Exactly. And to help us navigate this, we're using Jesse M. Hanamecki's book, The United Nations, a very short introduction. It's incredibly sharp.
So our goal here for you, the listener, pretty important, I think.
We really want to get past that simple back and forth, you know, the whole, is the UN a success or a failure argument?
It's just simple.
It is. We're aiming for something more like informed, pragmatic realism, understanding the UN for what it actually is, flaws and all, not some perfect ideal it never was.
Right. And that's the core tension Hanamecki really makes us face. Yeah. How can the UN be this indispensable place for global conversation, something the world clearly needs? Mm-hmm. And yet so often it seems totally ineffective, powerless when big crises hit. It's confusing. We're looking for that shortcut to understanding this complex reality.
And to get that realistic view, you need the right guide. Jesse M. Hanamecki, he's really well positioned. He's a professor of international history and politics at the Graduate Institute in Geneva.
Ah, Geneva. That's key, isn't it? Because Geneva's packed with major UN agencies. You got the WHO, the Human Rights Council, ILO, loads of them.
Exactly. So he's not just reading reports from New York. He's right there. He sees the functional side of the UN system working every day away from the Security Council spotlight.
So like a ground level view of the gears turning.
Precisely. And crucially, his background is in Cold War history, American foreign policy, great power politics. He understands how power actually works on the global stage.
So he's not a starry-eyed diplomat or just a cheerleader for the UN.
Not at all. He's a historian. He brings this analytical clarity rooted in geopolitical reality. He tells us what the UN is based on how countries behave, not just what the UN charter says it ought to be.
Okay, so let's unpack the book's main idea then. This seems to be the lens we need. Hanamecki basically argues the UN is inherently paradoxical, and we should judge it as a mirror.
Yes, a mirror reflecting the messy, contradictory state of international politics, not as some kind of world government, because it was never, ever set up to be that.
That mirror idea is quite powerful, actually. It shifts the focus instead of blaming the building in New York.
You look at the countries, the member states, the real tension, the book argues, is always between the UN's big ideals, collective security, human rights, and the hard reality of national sovereignty. Countries look out for themselves first.
So the UN is like a toolbox. Its success or failure depends entirely on whether the countries holding the tools, especially the powerful ones, actually agree on how or even if they want to use them.
Spot on. If the global mood is cooperative, the UN can get things done. If it's competitive or gridlocked, like during the Cold War, or, well, maybe now, the UN just reflects that gridlock. It mirrors the world.
Makes sense.
And the book traces this arc really well. It starts with why the League of Nations failed, the compromises made in 45 to get the U.S. and Soviets on board. Then the Cold War freeze, that brief burst of optimism in the 90s.
Right, after the Berlin Wall fell.
Yeah, and then into the challenges we see today with great power competition heating up again. It covers the political bodies, but also development, human rights, the whole picture.
Okay, let's dive into the details. We absolutely have to start with the Security Council and the veto power. The P5 U.S., Russia, U.K., France, China, they hold this veto. Hanamecki calls it the U.N.'s original sin.
He does. But then in the same breath, he calls it a pragmatic necessity, which sounds like a complete contradiction, right?
It really does. How can it be both?
Well, it's the uncomfortable truth at the heart of the U.N.'s founding. The veto is basically the price the major powers demanded to join. They wanted an escape hatch.
An escape hatch.
Yeah, a guarantee that the UN could never take enforcement action against them or their core interests. Why? Because the founders, remembering the League's failure, knew that if the organization tried to coerce a major power, the organization itself would likely be destroyed in the process.
Okay, so the veto sacrifices, let's say, immediate justice in some cases, like stopping a P5 member involved in a conflict in order to keep the whole system from collapsing. It keeps the big players at the table, even if they disagree fundamentally.
That's the logic. It prioritizes the long-term existence of the forum over enforcing every single principle in every case. And we saw the impact immediately. The Security Council was pretty much paralyzed by U.S.-Soviet rivalry throughout the Cold War.
Except for Korea. It's always cited.
The Korean War in 1950 is the famous exception, yeah. But that military action was only possible because the Soviet Union happened to be boycotting the council meetings at that precise moment. A fluke, really. After they came back, deadlock became the standard operating procedure for decades.
But okay, if the Security Council's often stuck, Hanamaki points out that's not the whole story. There's what he calls the functional UN, this huge network of agencies. The alphabet soup, as people call
Oh,
it.
yes, the alphabet soup. UNDP, UNICEF, WHO, WFP.
Exactly. And this is where the book suggests the UN has its most consistent and positive impact, right?
Right.
Far away from the New York political battles.
Absolutely. This is the UN system doing the day-to-day work. Think about UNICEF helping children, the World Health Organization coordinating responses to pandemics. We've seen how vital that is. Or the World Food Program delivering aid. It's constant, it's about coordination, and mostly it's not politically exclusive.
And it's not just about direct aid, is it? It's also about setting global standards. Hanamaki mentions the Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, and now the Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs.
These provide frameworks for everything from poverty reduction to climate action. This quieter work might not grab headlines, but it shapes national policies and international funding priorities for years, even decades.
Okay, let's swing back to the political side in New York then. You've got the Security Council, which we've talked about, with its power to authorize sanctions or military force under Chapter 7 of the Charter. That's the bit with the teeth?
That's the enforcement arm, yes. Limited by the veto, but it's where the binding decisions on peace and security are supposed to happen.
And then you have the General Assembly, the GA, which, let's be honest, often gets dismissed as just a talking shop. Every country gets one vote, but the resolutions don't legally bind anyone.
True, they're non-binding, but Hanamaki argues the GA is far from useless. It's the only place where every nation has a voice. It's the world's central forum for debate. And crucially, it's where international norms often get hammered out and legitimized.
Like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Exactly. The UDHR came out of the GA, and think historically, the GA became the main stage for the decolonization movement in the 50s and 60s. Developing countries, forming the G77 bloc, used it to push for economic justice and reshape the global conversation. It might lack military power, but it holds significant moral and political weight. It shapes agendas.
Let's talk about the Security Council's track record, though, because it's definitely mixed.
Yeah.
The first Gulf War in 1991, after Iraq invaded Kuwait, that's often held up as the ideal, the Council was united, acted decisively.
It was seen as textbook collective security in action. The Cold War was over. There was this brief moment of hope that the UN could finally work as intended.
But wow, that optimism didn't last long, did it?
No, it really didn't. That high point was followed by absolutely devastating failures just a few years later. Rwanda in 1994, Srebrenica in 1995. Horrific events where the UN, meaning its member states, failed to prevent genocide and massacres.
And those failures weren't because the UN building itself malfunctioned, right? It was about political will.
Yeah, precisely. It exposed the stark limits of political will among the powerful member states. They lacked the agreement, the resources, or maybe the courage to intervene effectively. It wasn't an institutional breakdown so much as a political and moral one by the key players.
And the soul searching after Rwanda and Srebrenica led to this idea of responsibility to protect, or R2P.
Yes, R2P was a major development. The core idea is quite radical in a way. It says that national sovereignty isn't absolute. If a state is unwilling or unable to protect its own people from mass atrocities, genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, then the international community has a responsibility, maybe even a duty, to step in.
Sounds good in principle, but controversial in practice.
Hugely controversial, because who decides when to intervene and how? The 2011 intervention in Libya is the classic example. It was authorized by the Security Council under R2P initially to protect civilians from Gaddafi's forces.
But it quickly became about regime change,
Yeah,
didn't it?
that's the criticism. Many argued the NATO-led coalition exceeded the mandate, turning a humanitarian mission into regime change, which wasn't authorized. And the aftermath in Libya wasn't exactly stable. So it highlighted all the potential pitfalls of R2P, how it can be interpreted, potentially misused, and the difficulty of achieving consensus.
Okay, so pulling all this together,
Yeah.
what are the main messages we should take away from Hanamaki's analysis? Let's try and boil it down to maybe three or four core themes. The first one seems to be that big contradiction we started with.
The paradox of indispensable ineffectiveness.
Yeah, the UN is absolutely essential. We need that forum for dialogue, for setting norms. But at the same time, it's often powerless to actually enforce order, mainly because of P5 interests and the veto.
Right. And understanding that paradox is key. It stops you from just getting completely cynical and dismissing the whole thing every time the Security Council hits a deadlock. It's built to be like this, in a way.
Okay, theme two feels related. The primacy of state sovereignty. The UN isn't, and never was meant to be, a world government.
Absolutely fundamental. It's an organization of sovereign states for sovereign states. The veto is just the most obvious symbol of this. Powerful countries weren't willing to give up ultimate control over their own fate or foreign policy.
So when you hear people say, why doesn't the UN just do something about a crisis?
They're often missing that basic point. The UN is its member states, particularly the powerful ones on the council. If they don't agree, the UN as an enforcement body can't act. It's not designed to override them.
Got it. What's theme three?
Theme three is that core idea we discussed, the UN as a mirror of world politics. Its effectiveness ebbs and flows depending on the geopolitical climate.
Right. Cold War paralysis, 1990s activism, maybe renewed gridlock today?
Exactly. The UN doesn't create the stead of world affairs. It reflects it. If the big powers are cooperating, the UN can be a useful tool. If they're at loggerheads, the UN mirrors that conflict.
And a final theme.
I'd say it's the power of norms and ideas. This is about the UN's soft power. Even when it can't enforce things militarily or economically, its long-term impact often comes from establishing frameworks.
Like the UDHR, R2P, the SDGs we mentioned?
Precisely. These create a shared language, set standards, put issues on the global agenda. They might not change things overnight, but over decades, these norms and ideas subtly influence international law, national policies, and how states are expected to behave. It's a slower, less visible form of power, but maybe more lasting.
Hanamaki has some really quotable lines that capture this realism. Maybe we can share a couple.
Yeah, definitely. His phrasing is very direct. Here's one that really sums up the member state issue. The UN was not designed to be a world government, but rather a tool for its sovereign member states. Its performance is therefore not a reflection of its own institutional failure, but of the collective political will, or lack thereof, of the international community.
That just puts the responsibility squarely back on the capitals of the world, doesn't it? Yeah. It wasn't the UN that failed. It was the members who failed to agree or act through it.
Exactly. And then there's his take on the veto, that paradox again. The Security Council's veto power is both the UN's original sin and its most vital life support system.
Oof, yeah, the uncomfortable truth. It causes paralysis and injustice sometimes, but without it, the whole thing might have collapsed long ago because the big powers would have just walked away.
It keeps them engaged, even if unhappily sometimes. And one more, focusing on the less visible side. The UN's greatest achievements are often invisible. The conflicts that never escalated, the diseases that were eradicated, the children who were fed.
That's such a vital point. We get so fixated on the Security Council dramas in New York, the vetoes, the failures, that we forget about the massive ongoing work of UNICEF, WHO, WSP, UNDP, the Refugee Agency, all that functional stuff that makes a tangible difference to millions of lives, but doesn't usually make the front page.
So thinking practically, how can you, listening to this, use these insights?
Well, first off, I think it helps with informed media consumption. When you see a headline saying UN fails in Syria or wherever, you can mentally translate that. It almost always means the UN Security Council member states failed to agree on effective action regarding Syria. It helps you pinpoint the problem correctly. It's usually geopolitics, not a bureaucratic failure in the UN Secretariat itself.
That's a really useful distinction. It stops you from just blaming the institution wholesale.
And it gives you context for foreign policy debates. You understand why countries like India, Brazil, Germany, Japan are pushing so hard for Security Council reform. They want a seat at the top table because that's where the real power lies. And the current P5 structure feels anachronistic, like a relic of 1945.
Yeah, it explains those ongoing diplomatic battles. And finally, I think Hanamaki's analysis really helps in debunking myths. There are two common opposing myths about the UN. One is that it's just a useless talking shop, completely ineffective. The other, sometimes you hear this from conspiracy theorists, is that it's some kind of sinister world government pulling the strings.
Right, two extremes.
And Hanamaki shows it's neither. It's not powerless, especially through its agencies and norm setting. But it's definitely not a world government. It's a limited, flawed, but vital tool for trying to manage cooperation and conflict in a world that fundamentally lacks a central authority. It's the best mechanism we have, perhaps.
You know, reflecting on this, what really stood out for me was the sheer scale and impact of that functional socioeconomic side. We spend so much media energy and political debate on Security Council, do peace and security stuff.
Which is important, of course.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But it feels like maybe 90% of the UN's actual day-to-day work and budget goes into development, health, human rights, refugees, climate coordination, stuff that operates relatively effectively, quietly in the background, but gets maybe 10% of the attention.
I think that's a fair assessment. And for me, the biggest takeaway is the value of this pragmatic realism Hanamaki champions. Moving beyond simple narratives of success or failure. The UN is deeply imperfect, deeply frustrating at times.
Definitely.
But imagine a world without it, without that permanent forum for dialogue, without the framework of international law it upholds, however imperfectly, without the coordinating work of its agencies. It wouldn't be global harmony. It would likely be far more chaotic, more dominated by raw great power competition with even fewer rules.
So it's flawed, but maybe indispensable in preventing something much worse. Humanity's best attempt so far, perhaps.
Perhaps. It's the difficult reality we have to work with. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.